Eating local foods is trendy, it can be fun, and the results are often delicious. But today, we'll find out how the local foods movement is changing our economy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with the author of a new report, the first of its kind, that breaks down the economics of local food in Iowa. We'll also meet several Iowa producers, a beekeeper, and two vegetable producers. We'll talk about their place in the local food economy. And then later in the hour, I'll talk with an Iowa chef who will whet your appetite for the turducken. All that and more. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's easy to tell that the local foods movement in Iowa is growing. We can tell from the business at farmers markets, the increasing number of restaurant menus that identify local sources for ingredients, more CSAs, community supported agriculture groups, starting up all the time, and just a general buzz about local foods. But we don't have good, solid economic numbers that tell the story of that growth. And that's something that my first guest today is trying to change. Corey Bregendahl is one of the co-authors of a new report, 2012 Economic Impacts of Iowa's Regional Food Systems Working Group. The report comes from the working group and from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. Corey is an associate scientist at the Leopold Center. Hello, Corey.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And tell us about the goals for this report, because it really is the first of its kind.
It is. The goals were really to measure the economic impact of the work that's been happening in Iowa for the past decade. And so we have a group which is really a network of many Iowans who are cooperating to support a strong regional food system, focusing on community-based, economically sustainable, and environmentally and socially responsible food enterprises. And so we meet on a quarterly basis to learn and share information, tools, and experiences with each other. And there are a lot of different people who are involved in this. There are state agencies. The Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship is involved. Iowa State University Extension. There are producers, processors, buyers, everybody that you could think of along the food value chain. And so, but what we have that's unique to Iowa is that we have basically a sub-network within this interest-based group of 15 geographically based regions. And each of those regions is led by a coordinator. And so what we did, we thought, those coordinators have relationships with farmers, they have relationships with buyers, and they're brokering all kinds of food, local food commerce transactions every day. And so we thought we need to tap those relationships and get some good data that has been missing so far.
Well, and what were the gaps? What are the things that you really felt had been missing so far?
Well, we knew from the 2007 Census of Agriculture that local food sales direct to consumers was $16 million. And, of course, in February, those new reports will come out from the USDA Census. But that's just direct to consumers. What we didn't know was how much our restaurants and institutions, schools, colleges, residential living facilities, caterers, all these other people, grocery stores, what are they buying? Because they are buying huge volumes of local food, mm-hmm. especially in comparison to some of the CSAs and farmers markets.
So really, you felt that we were missing perhaps the majority of sales of what we're calling local foods in Iowa.
That's right. That's right. From these high-volume buyers.
All right. So how do you track down all of that information? A lot of these local producers are obviously working very hard to create their own network, to make their own connections, and they're not necessarily calling you and saying, hey, I just made a sale.
No, that's right. And that's why we really relied on our coordinators within this network, these regional food coordinators, and each of them at some time in the past 10 years has received some seed funding from the Leopold Center to develop their local food system. And so they make these contacts. And so we really ask them to tap their networks to recruit at least three buyers of local foods and three farmers who were selling local foods to participate in a survey that we jointly developed as a group. And so with that survey, we just focused on four change indicators, if you will, because we didn't want it to get complicated, and we know how difficult it is to convene and coordinate all of this, and so we wanted to keep it very basic. And so what we did is we agreed upon measuring the value of local food sold by farmers, so asking farmers what they were selling to everybody, not just to individuals, but also to restaurants and grocery stores, institutions, and then the value of local foods that were purchased by institutions. So those regional food coordinators already had contacts with those buyers. In some cases, they were already facilitating transactions between them and the farmers. And then we also were interested in looking at jobs created as a result of local foods commerce, because there has been nothing out there on that. Certainly, there have been projections and economic models, which is good work. We just wanted to test those models. And then finally, dollars leveraged by the regional food group coordinators to support their work.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the things that you found. And again, I mean, this is a fairly small sample size. Do you feel like you have a strong picture of what's happening in Iowa because of this?
We have a snapshot, but I would caution everybody listening that this is just a piece of the bigger pie. And so it's reliable, but it's incomplete. And so this is just one little portion. So what we found was, we had results that were $10.5 million of local food sales from 103 farmers. You'll recall I mentioned that 2000 census of agriculture that measured local food sales to direct to consumers. And that was, they measured back then $16.5 million, and that was from 3,000 farmers. So really what we're seeing is we actually measured essentially two-thirds of what they did, but only from a small fraction, less than a half a percent, of those they interviewed or they surveyed in that census. And so we feel like there's a lot more going on out there, and we're going to try to have discussions to see if we can have better measurement at state and federal levels.
All right. So in looking at the amount of sales to institutions and the value of these transactions, obviously, since this kind of report hasn't been done before, it's difficult to compare it to the past. But when you look at that snapshot, what do you see?
I see there's a lot more activity going on than we were all fully aware of. And, you know, just the fact that we measured nearly $9 million worth of product that was purchased by 74 buyers that cooperated with their local food coordinators suggests that we're basically leaving out a whole measurable market. We're ignoring them. And in so doing, we're not understanding the impact of what people typically think of as small pockets of local food activity. When you combine it all together, it's bigger than we ever imagined.
And is this also data that will be helpful to producers in the future? Because as I mentioned, a lot of these small producers, they start with an acre or two, they start growing things, they start selling things, and they are scrambling to make connections and to make sales that will help them make a living. Will you be able to use this information to show those producers and say, hey, this is how somebody else is making a living?
Yes. And that's actually one of the reasons why we did the statewide report, but we also did 15 customized regional reports so that the local food coordinators could take this to their farmers and their buyers and say, hey, this is what you're contributing to our local economy. This is what you're contributing to the state economy. And that's really to engage, keep those farmers and buyers engaged in the conversation so that they know that they're part of a bigger movement. And we've heard that time and time again from those people who attend our quarterly meetings and get together and say, oh, I thought I was alone out in the wilderness, but now I find that I'm part of something bigger, and there I can learn from this person and that person, and they're making some great connections that are informing their business decisions, because this is about business. It's not hobby farming.
Right. And let's talk about jobs creation, because as I mentioned, I mean, these smaller farms that we're talking about here, and not all of the farms are small, but many of them are smaller than what are traditional conventional agricultural farms. They start in small ways and grow larger and really do make an impact. But can people on let's say a 5-acre farm, is that the kind of thing that can support an entire job and help somebody make a living that they can support themselves and their family on?
Yes, we in our analysis we found, yes, there was the average number of jobs per operation was about 1.2 or 1.5. And so, which means that's the average. But there are operations that are employing more people. And we found, we measured 36 farm-based jobs were created as a result of local foods commerce in 2012. The 10 of those were full-time equivalent. We wanted to measure that because we wanted to know, are these livable wage jobs, although
right.
we didn't ask for the wages, but we did ask whether they were year-round and full-time. And so this seems like a very small number, and indeed it's not something that, you know, is just going to make the legislature or anybody say, oh, let's pour all this money into this. But it's, again, like I said before, it's just a small slice of the pie, and so we actually have a lot more work to do. We're going to reproduce this next year and get more people on board, and I think we're going to see those jobs increase.
Well, and you also
go ahead.
You took a look at the kinds of economic incentives and did some comparison contrast with bringing in big corporations like Facebook, et cetera, and the number of economic incentives that are given to these companies, and the small portion of economic incentives that do make their way to these small farmers. And you found that the impact of tax dollars in job creation in this way is very significant. Can you give us just a snapshot in a minute of what you found?
Yes. Well, we took the leverage that the regional food coordinators had managed to bring into their work, and we compared that money, broke it down by what was publicly funded. So these were public grants through the federal or state level potentially. And then we calculated the public cost and compared it to the number of jobs that were created. And we found that the public cost of creating one full-time equivalent job in the local food sector was $17,800. Economists before us have calculated retail jobs that were not full-time have cost the Iowa public $69,000 and some high-tech jobs $580,000. And so you can see that the cost of creating local food sector jobs is very inexpensive.
So we're almost out of time for this part of the show, but in looking ahead to next year, what numbers are you most excited about seeing next year now that you'll have something to compare to?
I'm excited to see whether the public cost, that low public cost, holds as we maybe, I'm assuming we'll see an increase in the number of jobs. Certainly as we increase the number of respondents, we're going to see an increase, obviously, in the number of sales unless there's a flood or a drought that curtails production and then therefore purchasing. So I think that's a big thing. Institutional purchases of local foods, I think, are something that are getting more and more attention because it hasn't been measured before. And so we're really excited about seeing those numbers rise.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Corey Bregendahl is one of the co-authors of the new report, 2012 Economic Impacts of Iowa's Regional Food Systems Working Group from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the local foods economy. There's a new report out from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. It's the 2012 Economic Impacts of Iowa's Regional Food Systems Working Group. And I was talking just a moment ago with one of the authors of this report. You can also find a condensed version of the report on our Facebook page if you look for Iowa Public Radio and look at some of the findings yourself. And we're going to continue this conversation about local foods and the economic impact of this kind of production, this kind of eating. And we'll meet a number of producers in a few minutes. Then later on in the hour, a different kind of eating local. We're going to talk with an Iowa chef who is preparing 72 turduckins for Thanksgiving this year. And if you don't know what a turducken is, we'll find out about that a little later on as well. My next guest is Rachel Wobeater. She is the local food program manager at the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. She's also involved with the Regional Food Systems Working Group. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
And I was just talking to Corey Bregendahl about the institutional food buying and the economic impact of that in this local foods economy. And I know that that's one of the things that you're involved in at UNI. Can you give me a little bit of an overview of the program at UNI? I know you're fairly new to it, but it's been in place for about a decade, right?
That's right. Yeah, I started back in January of this year. And I have several hats in my position. I am the UNI Local Food Program Manager, but I also work with seven counties, so I have a regional reach as well. But here at UNI, like you said, they have been sourcing local food actually since about 1996, and they've gradually been increasing their purchases. They've developed relationships with farmers in the region, and I see my role helping them educate the campus, let people know, students know that they're purchasing local food, and help express the value to the campus about their local food.
Can you give me some concrete examples of some of the ways that UNI uses local food?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, they purchase between, between 20% and 30% of their food comes from within the state of Iowa. And so that's going out into the cafeterias on a daily basis. They're able to utilize, sometimes when a farmer has a surplus, the farmer may contact you and I and say, hey, I have a huge truckload of sweet corn. Can you take it off my hands? So they really do add a valuable market for our local producers. We also do source a lot of local meat sometimes three hogs, three cows a month. And so that keeps one of our local lockers in business and really, really helps them have a strong base for their business.
Is it cost effective for UNI?
Yeah, it is. Actually, you can develop relationships. Like I said, when you can get these surpluses, sometimes you can get a better value. But at the same time, we are talking about the economy here. We're talking about having valuable jobs for people in Iowa. UNI recognizes that, and they do want to pay a just price for food.
And I know when I went to school and I ate at the dorm food service, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about where the food was actually coming from. How is that communicated to students at UNI?
Well, actually, that's one of the first projects I worked on when I got here. Was some outreach to students. And so I identified a student photographer, Justin Allen. And we visited the farms that UNI sources their food from and took pictures, and we were calling it Faces of Our Farmers. And so we're really trying to put the story behind the food. And so these images have been printed, and they are in the cafeteria lines in the dining centers at UNI next to the food that is sourced locally. And then we also are doing a photo exhibit that will be in the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center starting in December. So that'll be open to the community and just be another way for people on campus to see where their food is coming from.
And of course, it's very difficult to measure the results of that kind of educational effort, but are there anecdotal stories that you can share about how students are responding?
Absolutely. That's my favorite part of my job, is hearing those stories. The photographer, for instance, the student photographer, he told me that after going to all these farms, each one of them got him more excited about local food. In fact, he's done a lot of different photography projects, and he says this is his favorite one. And he is much more interested in local food. We visited a local creamery. They do yogurt and dairy, and he now says he packs his refrigerator with the yogurt from that dairy, Country View Dairy. So I think that tells it all. I've also, taken students to farms, doing farm tours, and I think that always is really impressive to them. I think they really appreciate seeing the hard work that local farmers put into producing food.
The conversation, the term that we hear thrown around on Talk of Iowa and in any many other media sources is local foods. But your involvement is with the Regional Food Systems Working Group. And in this report and in your work, there is a lot of emphasis on regional. Can you tell me why that's important?
Yeah. Well, and just to back that up a little bit, I always, when I do talk about local food, people always want to put a number to what how far okay. local is, you know, 100 or 200 and 200 miles. And I like to say local is should also be described as a community food system. So when you're buying something, you can just label it, you know, is it helping my neighbors? Is it helping my community? Then I consider that local. And so when, you know, being part of a regional food system in the state of Iowa, I think we, as coordinators, we all learn a lot from each other. We need to learn lessons from each other, and, you know, we can help propel our work by sharing our stories with each other. And also, economically, we want to see the whole state succeed. And we know that each region might not be producing all the different types of foods that are needed. And so we may need to source those from, you know, a region or from, you know, across the state of Iowa. So we all can contribute what we can from our region. And then, you know, the state of Iowa, we can kind of see the whole picture.
Now, again, we know that this movement is growing, although until this year, we haven't really had good economic numbers on it, and we'll have even better mm-hmm. numbers next year. What do you consider to be the biggest challenges for the local foods movement as time goes on?
Yeah, I think there's a few things, and it varies a lot from each region in Iowa. When I do go to these quarterly regional food system working group meetings, hear the stories from the fellow coordinators, it is quite different. Some regions have a lot of awareness about local food. That is, the citizens are really excited about it. It may be trendy, and other regions don't have any education, and so. For those coordinators, they just really need to get more excitement around it, more events. For me in our region, I think one of the challenges is getting more young farmers. We do have, you know, an aging farmer base, and so to continue the supply and continue, you know, increasing the level of local food that we have available, I do think we do. We do need to bring more producers in. And so this economic impact report really does help us show that to producers, say, you know, come to our region, here's what we have, here's what our institutional buyers have spent on local food. And so it's a great tool to help entice new producers.
Local food is trendy right now. Do you mm-hmm. worry that the novelty might wear off?
I don't think so. I think when people make the connections with a local farmer, they don't want to go back to the grocery store anymore. They love the flavor, they love the quality, they love the story behind their food, and so I certainly don't think we can go backwards. And I think these people who do the local purchasing will keep telling their story, and other people will see the value.
Rachel, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you, Charity.
Rachel Wobeter is the local food program manager at the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa, and also part of the Regional Food Systems Working Group that put out this new report, the 2012 Economic Impacts of Iowa's Regional Food Systems Working Group. And now we're going to meet some of the producers that are making local food possible in Iowa and in the region. And my first guest now is Pat Ennis. He's a beekeeper. He takes care of the north half of Spring Valley Honey Farms. That's 1,700 bees in Perry, Iowa. Hi, Pat.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm just more than happy to be here.
So tell me a little bit about Spring Valley Honey Farms. How much honey do you produce every year?
This year we had about an 80-pound average, which added up to about 55-gallon drums of honey.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes, it is.
And where does all this honey go?
We do most of the marketing in the Des Moines-Ames area. We're working on North Central Iowa, where I'm up from, by Mason City in that area. We do sell some of it to other honey producers in the state of Iowa that can't produce enough honey. So we try to keep it local, but some of it does go to bigger companies.
How did you get involved, Pat?
Basically, I've Something I wanted to do as a kid was be a beekeeper. Right now I make my living on beekeeping. It took 32 years to get here, but I work for Spring Valley Honey Farm, like I said. And when I did an interview for Buy Local, Buy Fresh, we at that time had hired two more people, and since then we've actually hired another one. So it's just something that I've always wanted to do. I love talking about bees. I love encouraging people to learn a little bit more about them, learn about the honey, because that's my biggest problem is people are uneducated about what good quality honey is.
Well, and tell us, what makes your honey special?
Actually, my honey is just as good as most other beekeepers in Iowa. And the thing that people need to learn is a local beekeeper does not have to high-pressure filter or take all the beneficial nutrients from the honey, the enzymes, the things like that, and they don't have to heat it to get them a good quality raw honey. Where the commercial packers, they want it to sit in the grocery store for, you know, up to 2 years, and so they do all that high-pressure filtering, and they heat their honey, and basically they've killed everything that's good in there, so you just have another sweetener. So to me, they need to buy their honey from somebody local, whether it's Spring Valley Honey Farm or the guy that has two hives of bee down the road, that somebody that's going to provide them with a good quality honey is what they need to find.
Well, and let's talk about all that stuff in the honey before it gets processed. What kinds of benefits do you feel there would be to me to eating local honey?
Raw honey is basically good because the nutritional value of it. You got me stumped on a question here. The benefits of raw honey are endless. If you do a Google search on it, you're going to come up with so many things. But the nutritional value of the honey, the enzymes, the things like that that are in the honey is what is important. And once they high-pressure filter it, they take all that stuff out.
Well, and I've heard that it could even help me with allergies.
It can. If you buy honey from your local area, and when I say local, I don't mean 100 miles. I mean 8 to 10 miles from where you live. If you have allergies from that area and you eat honey from that area, basically the bees have gone out to those flowers. There's little particles of pollen in your honey that you're actually eating, so you're helping to build up your immunity. And some people it does help, some people it doesn't. But the variety, most people it does help.
And we were talking earlier about job creation, and you mentioned now you get to make a living as a beekeeper, and at Spring Valley Honey Farms you'd hired two more people after you. How many people are employed by Spring Valley Honey Farms?
Right now there's 9 people that are employed at Spring Valley Honey Farm.
Wow. And we're asking people on our Facebook and Twitter today to talk about the local foods that are going to be on their Thanksgiving table this Thanksgiving. How about you? What are you having for dinner tomorrow?
Basically, we're having some vegetables. It's kind of hard to get carrots and stuff like that, but we can have squash from local producers. Actually, the squash is coming out of our garden. Things like that. The honey, we always have the honey. It's just one of those things. We can't have a meal without honey. So those are some of the things that we're having.
Well, happy Thanksgiving, Pat.
Yep, thank you.
Pat Ennis is a beekeeper. He takes care of the north half of Spring Valley Honey Farms. That adds up to 1,700 bees in Perry, Iowa. And we're continuing to talk to different producers around the state. Right now with me in the studio is Barb Grijalda. She is the proprietor of Back to Basics Farm in Fairfield, Iowa. Hello, Barb.
Good morning.
And your farm started as a garden. Tell me a little bit about the history of your farm.
Right. About 13 years ago, I started selling at our local farmer's market, kind of out of need. I drove school bus for our local school system. And during the summer break, it's like, oh, I need extra income. So I started selling from our little garden. I lived close to Packwood, Iowa at the time. And so I just picked a few things out of my garden that was in my backyard and baked some baked goods and take them to the local market. And people were standing in line, and I would sell out right away. And so this went on for about 3 years, 3 summers, and then I took a few summers off to kind of get an in-home bakery going, which I still have going today, Back to the Basics Bakery, and I deliver to several gas stations in our area. And then I started dating my fiancé now, Rick Searin, and we purchased a farm north of Fairfield about 6 years ago. So I'm like, okay, we can get back into going back to the market. So we cleared one little garden space and started going back to the market. And my old customers I used to have from before were like, oh, we're excited that you're back. And where I live in Fairfield, we have a lot of customers that like organic only. And so I probably have 200 to 300 customers that just buy because of the organic aspect of it. And so each year I would just add to my gardens, and now we're over 10 acres, wow, probably close to 20 acres of what we have.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we are going to take a short break here. We're going to get back to this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Barb Grijalda of Back to the Basics Farm in Fairfield, Iowa. We're going to meet another producer in just a moment. And then later on in the hour, we'll find out from an Iowa chef, Ben Halperin, from Augusta Restaurant in Oxford about the turducken and why he's making 72 for Thanksgiving this year. That's coming up in just a moment. Also, this show is inspired by a new report about the economic impact of local foods. You can find a link to a summary of that report on our Facebook page. If you go to Iowa Public Radio, the report from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. Of course, you can follow Iowa Public Radio and the talk shows at IPR Talk at Twitter. You can also follow me at Charity Nebby. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebby. This hour, we're talking about the local foods economy in Iowa. And we've been taking a look at a new report, the 2012 Economic Impacts of Iowa's Regional Food Systems. And now we're talking to producers around the state. With me right now is Barb Grijalda of Back to the Basics Farm in Fairfield, Iowa, also of Back to the Basics Bakery. And Barb, we were talking a little bit before about the history of your produce, and you started doing this about 13 years ago, and it has grown, and now you have your own farm, and you're continuing to sell at the farmers market and continuing to sell your baked goods as well. Give me an idea of the different kinds of produce you grow.
We grow pretty much everything. If you can grow it in Iowa, we pretty much grow it. We start out in the spring with our greens and radishes and peas and things like that, and then we have, last year I planted 1,000 pounds of potatoes and 75 pounds of onions, which, you know, you get a lot off of each thing. So we have asparagus. We're pretty well known in the area for our sweet corn. We have popcorn that we produced 3,000 pounds of popcorn this year.
Wow.
And we had always picked it by hand, my fiance and I. And then we just recently, this year, we purchased a one row corn picker from an auction. So we were pretty excited. And we had always shelled it off with an antique hand crank sheller, but we converted it to electric this year. So we didn't think we could get through 3,000 pounds of popcorn by ourselves.
Yeah, I can't.
Without
imagine.
Giving up.
Now, obviously, this has grown for you. Personally, it started out as something just for a little extra income. Now, this is what you do for a living. How have you seen the local foods movement change over the 13 years that you've been involved?
Well, not up until the last couple of years. I didn't really think much about where it was going and how it was impacting other people until Jan Swinton from our Hometown Harvest Pathfinder. She's our local food coordinator. And so I became part of the Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaign. And we get published into the Hometown Harvest book, where you as a customer could come or go to the book or even on the website. And if you're looking for a certain thing, or you're just looking for a farmer's market to go to buy fresh local food, you can go to that. And up until two years ago when I met Jan, I really didn't think much about it. So now that we're in the book, we're out there, and I deliver to 6 restaurants. I provide to our local Hy-Vee food store when I have abundant, and we keep ourselves going. And I do a lot at the farmers market in our area, Fairfield Farmers Market. So never really thought about the impact of what it was until just a couple of years
ago. Well, and so this is your full-time job.
This is my full-time job.
And is your fiance also able to work full time?
My fiance works for Vision Ag. He's a seed salesman and does a lot of the soil sampling.
All right, so this is a side job
right.
for him, although I'm sure he puts in a lot of hours.
He puts in a lot of hours, and, you know, he does the agronomy part of it. So a lot of evenings, he'll come home. I call him my water boy. It's like if we need water, he brings water home in the big tank and makes sure everything gets water. But we kind of steered away from watering this year. It's like whatever it is, because you just spend so much time watering things, and then, you know, with the bugs and everything,
right.
we're organic. But he does help me out quite a bit, so.
Oh, terrific. Well, Barb, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Barb Grijalda is of Back to the Basics Farm in Fairfield, Iowa. And one more producer to meet today, Dale Rash, is the operator of Bridgewater Farm in Adair County. Hi, Dale.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Now, I know that you've been farming for 35 years. How long have you been working on Bridgewater Farm?
Bridgewater Farm started basically back in 2006. And we started with a small garden, only about 30 feet wide by 100 feet long. And today it's grown. We have about 12 acres, and all of our stuff is all grown organically.
And so give me an idea of the variety of things you grow on your land.
Oh, we have about an acre of asparagus. And this year we planted about 250 new rhubarb plants. We already had some. We have a peach trees, apple trees, pear trees. Also, we grow just about all kinds of vegetables. We had about 2 acres of potatoes this year. We raised about 20,000 pounds of sweet potatoes. I mean, we have we had over 1,200 tomato plants, 700 pepper plants, and just we raise just about whatever you can here in Iowa, but it's some things are really tough to grow. We have a tough time with carrots and like parsnips and things like that there, because when you grow everything organically, you have to fight all the weeds and bugs and stuff, so it just makes it a lot more difficult.
There are a lot of challenges. You also have livestock, right?
Yes, we do. We have laying hens, and then we raise broilers, and then also we have cattle and hogs. And we use the manure and stuff from those that we put on our area that we have. And then my other ground that I have is all in hay. We don't have any other corn or soybeans. And so we pretty much, we don't have to bring anything in as fertilizer or anything, because we grow it all ourselves.
Now, after spending 35 years in agriculture, what made you want to farm this way?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is on our garden and stuff, we wanted to know kind of what we were eating. And then we got to the point where it was coming from and how it was produced. And then we just got to where we had more than we could utilize or can and stuff for ourselves. So then we started going to a few markets and stuff. And today I do the Atlantic Farmers Market, the Creston, the Winterset, Johnston, the VA Hospital, and the Drake Farmers Market. And then also we sell to hospitals, nursing homes, and restaurants. We also sell to Gateway Market and Campbell's in Des Moines. And also, we just started selling to Hy-Vee, too. So we've got I just got hooked up with another lady that we've been selling everything pretty much here in Iowa. But I just got hooked up with a lady from up by Harlan, and she's going to start taking some of my stuff and selling it out in Omaha and Council Bluffs
oh, well.
For me.
Can you keep up with demand?
Oh, well, no. Not really, but I mean, we found out the last 2 years that it's better to go slow because we tried to expand too much, and the last 2 years has been really our worst 2 years, with it being so wet this spring and so cold, and then it turned around and then it, you know, got dry.
Yeah.
That the last 2 years we've had to use over 30,000 feet of drip water line to try and water things. Otherwise, we wouldn't have raised anything.
Right.
It was just so dry.
But Dale, this is your full-time job. Is your son also working full-time on the farm?
Yes. Yes, he is. My son, Tyler. And yes, it keeps us busy. Plus, we hired about five part-time people to help too. And that's the worst thing. We have kind of a hard time finding people that really want to do this kind of work too.
It's hard work.
Yeah.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you.
Dale
you
Rash.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too, and happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, same to you.
Dale Rash is the operator of Bridgewater Farm in Adair County. It's a 40-acre farm, and they have all kinds of produce as well as livestock on the farm. This hour, we've been talking about the local foods economy. We've been talking numbers and also talking to producers around the state of Iowa. And again, if you'd like more information about the report that inspired this program, you can go to our Facebook page and look for Iowa Public Radio, and we put up a summary of the report from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. This is Talk of Iowa. When Ben and Jerry Halperin moved to Iowa from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, they brought a lot of New Orleans traditions with them. They opened the Augusta Restaurant in Oxford, and people flock from all over to enjoy classic New Orleans dishes. And one of their more unusual offerings has become a Thanksgiving tradition at the restaurant and in people's homes. Right now, they are busy preparing 72 turduckins for holiday tables in Iowa. And Chef Ben Halperin is here with me now. All right, Ben, for people who don't know, what is a turducken?
A turducken is a chicken stuffed in a duck stuffed in a turkey, usually with the stuffing involved in the middle there, too.
All right, and you take the bones out?
That's my method. I take all the bones out so that it's seamless and you can just slice it kind of like a meatloaf.
All right. And I was actually doing a little bit of research about this. Apparently, this tradition goes back a lot longer than I would have given it credit for. But when did you first encounter a turducken?
Oh, when I was down in New Orleans, you know, we'd go to somebody's house for the holidays, and they'd almost always had turducken.
Really?
Yeah.
Almost always?
Just about, yeah. There is turducken involved for a holiday celebration.
How long does it take to make one?
It takes me 3 days. I cut the turkey, debone it, and then brine it overnight. And then I smoke it. After I tie it up, I smoke it, and then finish it in the oven for a few hours.
All right. And is that a classic traditional recipe, or is that your own spin on it?
That's my own spin. I think it came from a few things, but I always want to try to avoid the turkey leg fight because I'm a big fan of the turkey leg. So now you can slice it several times, and then everybody can have some if they want.
How many people does a turducken serve?
About 12.
Okay. So that's a big offering.
Yes, yes. You know, it depends. We figure they're about 12 pounds, so we figure about a pound a person. That's a lot for some people and not a lot for others. It just depends, you know, how much turkey they want to eat on Thanksgiving.
Is this what will be on your Thanksgiving table?
I'm not sure yet. We haven't quite decided. I know it's only a couple days away, but we haven't decided what we're going to do for Thanksgiving.
I realize that it tastes like chicken and duck and turkey, but when you put it all together, what does it taste like?
Well, it's smoked, so some of the dark meat takes on more of a hammy flavor, and then the white meat, like smoked turkey. And I make a cornbread stuffing with celery and onions and garlic and plenty of andouille sausage, which is a spicy New Orleans sausage, and I mix that with cornbread. And so that adds a nice texture in there, too. And then I make gravy that goes over it. And I've got a lot of duck bone, or, you know, a lot of bones, a lot of poultry bones to roast and make a nice rich stock out of, and that's what I make my gravy from.
So for the people that order these from you for their own Thanksgiving tables, is this a novelty for them, or do you have people who've been doing this for a few years and need to have a turducken on the Thanksgiving table to make it Thanksgiving?
Yeah, you know, there are quite a few customers who are who get one every year, and but you know, they're new people too. We're always trying to get the word out that we have them available, and this year we did get a lot of new customers. Though I do recognize a lot of the names, and we also do a business for Christmas, where we sell a lot of turduckens for Christmas. And last year, we also did quite a few for Super Bowl Sunday.
Really?
Yeah.
So, forget about the dip and the buffalo wings. Have a turducken for your Super Bowl party.
Yeah, it's a great time.
So, for you, is this a dish that you think really tastes wonderful, or is it the novelty that is more attractive?
Oh, I like the way it tastes. It is a novelty. It's just a thing. I don't know. And it's a New Orleans thing, and it's something that's been made popular on TV. John Madden always has one every year. And it's just one of those things from New Orleans that is known about nationally, and many people up here haven't had one. So I'm trying to give them that opportunity.
And if you're making 72 turduckens for people who've ordered them,
yep,
and you're making turduckens for the restaurant, and they take 3 days to make, how are you feeling about turduckens right now?
Right now, I'm a little bit tired of looking at them. But well, that's all right. I'm nearing the end here. We're almost, tomorrow's our last day for pickup for Thanksgiving, so the end is in sight.
All right. And for, you mentioned in New Orleans, there was a turducken on almost every Thanksgiving table when you went to people's houses for Thanksgiving. What are the other New Orleans touches that should be on a Thanksgiving table, do you think?
Well, there was always some seafood involved. Often down south, there was seafood involved in their turduckens and their stuffing. But we left it out here because we want to try to please everybody. And, you know, sometimes people can't eat it or don't care for it, so we didn't offer the seafood in them. So that type of thing. And then, you know, oyster dressing is in there, usually somewhere. And really nice desserts, bread puddings and such. And that's another thing we're offering this year is assortment of sides that go with. We actually offer every year green beans and sweet potatoes and bread pudding. And our Derby pie, which is chocolate chip pecan pie with bourbon.
All right. Well, I'm hungry, Ben.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Ben Halperin is the chef and co-owner of Augusta Restaurant in Oxford, Iowa. And they are preparing 72 turduckens for people who want to have them on their Thanksgiving tables this year. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The show is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Tony Daner. You can podcast the show or stream it on our website, iowapublicradio.org. And hey, if you missed the books shows earlier this week, our books for adults and books for kids, you can find the complete lists from those shows on our website, iowapublicradio.org, as well. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up on Monday, I'll talk with Richard Louv. He's the author of Last Child in the Woods and coined the term nature deficit disorder. And tomorrow, of course, Lynn Rosetto Casper will be here with Turkey Confidential. Happy Thanksgiving.